Father Justin, geek from my youth. In the last episode of our podcast, we pretty firmly established that Arthur may or may not have been historical. More seriously, we looked at the sources of the historical sources of the Arthurian legend and found that the significance of the death of Arthur stems from really the collapse of the last remnants of Roman Britain. It's about at this period of time that as the Saxons are coming into the ascendancy, that we have the beginnings of Arthur mentioned both in the Annals of Wales and in Nennius's History of the Britons, completely glossed over by Gildas, but mentioned also much later by William of Malmesbury as somebody that has stuck around in the memory of the British people. Why? Well, as we said, it seems to stem from this collapse of civilization, this kind of feeling that the world is ending. And what becomes very closely, or the person that becomes very closely associated with that, is this man, Arthur. Whether he's king or a military leader who is serving under a king, I tend towards the latter, if he was historical, what's significant in these very limited historical pieces of data is that, he died and things got worse after he died. So, for example, in the Annals of Wales, we saw in the year 93, we have this first mention of Arthur, this second mention, I guess, in the Annals of Wales, the Strife of Camlann, in which Arthur and Mordred fell, and there was death in Britain and Ireland. And that's it. But again, they fell, and then there was death. And then in Nennius, we don't actually even have the any account of the death of Arthur, but we do have his note that immediately following his mention of Arthur, the more the Saxons were vanquished, the more they sought for new supplies of Saxons from Germany, so that kings, commanders, and military bands were invited from almost every province. So things get a whole lot worse. And that's really about it in terms of what we have about the death of Arthur in the historical records, or in the records that we would consider historical. In this episode, I want to examine the transition from Arthur as an historical figure to Arthur as a literary figure, as embodied in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. What we see in the earlier text that we have access to is a concern for, or a focus on, what happened. This is what happened, establishing what happened. This is what I saw. When we get to Geoffrey of Monmouth, who's writing in about the year 1138, quite a bit after the fact, and working from historical records, is, to put it politely, maybe, less of a concern with what actually happened and more of a concern with the story. And now, it's presented as history, which, as we'll get to, is something that really annoys certain of Geoffrey's contemporaries and even some moderns as well. If you look at how Geoffrey portrays Arthur, we have in Geoffrey both a lack of concern with verifying historical details, and a more of an interest in Arthur as a figure, as a heroic figure who is worthy of a really good story. And it's probably for this reason, and because Geoffrey wrote in Latin, and because of the historical circumstance of Geoffrey's writing. He's writing not too long after the conquest of Anglo-Saxon Britain by William the Conqueror, the Norman, from France, that this This account of Arthur, which is much fuller and more detailed than what we get previously, becomes kind of the definitive source for what then gets developed by the French writers, and ultimately what gets taken up and developed into kind of the full-fledged English literary and really definitive English literary text, which we'll start into our next episode. Sir Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur. So Geoffrey is writing a history of the kings of Britain. He's begins all the way back with well, even prior to Julius Caesar, and brings it all the way up to the present, working from some of the sources that he had available to him, and even working from certain British sources that perhaps are not extant now. But as I say, he's not particularly concerned with establishing the veracity of a lot of his accounts, as can be seen by the content. So Arthur in Geoffrey of Monmouth is a great warrior, as we've seen, does beat back the Saxons, but probably one of the most interesting and frustrating additions to the Arthurian legend that comes out of Geoffrey of Monmouth is Arthur as a conqueror of Rome. This is not mentioned at all in, as far as I can tell, in any previous sources, and gets him a lot of flack. My hero, C.S. Lewis, I particularly love his condemnation of Geoffrey, so I'm gonna actually read it at length. The other thing that Geoffrey that he focuses on are these prophecies of Merlin, and I have to read just a little bit of them because they're wild, really, really fascinating stuff. C.S. Lewis, when he's writing about this in a posthumously published essay, The Genesis of a Medieval Book, writing from a fairly modern literary perspective, he says Geoffrey is of course important for the historians of the Arthurian legend. As I say, he's the one who really fleshes it out and gives us Arthur as the beginnings really of a literary figure. But since the interest of those historians has seldom lain chiefly in literature, they have not always remembered to tell us that he is an author of mediocre talent and no taste. In the Arthurian parts of his work, the lion's share falls to the insufferable rigmarole of Merlin's prophecies and to the foreign conquests of Arthur. These latter are, the foreign conquests are, of course, at once the least historical and the least mythical thing about Arthur. If there was a real Arthur, he did not conquer Rome. If the story has roots in Celtic paganism, this campaign is not one of them. It is fiction. And what fiction? We can suspend our disbelief in an occasional giant or enchantress. They have friends in our subconscious and in our earliest memories. Imagination can easily suppose that the real world has room for them. But vast military operations scrawled over the whole map of Europe and excluded by all the history we know are a different matter. We cannot suspend our disbelief. We don't even want to. The annals of senseless and monotonously successful aggression are dreary enough reading, even when true. When blatantly, stupidly false, they are unendurable. I think if you read what Geoffrey writes, both in terms of the prophecies of Merlin, and in terms of his senseless annals of fictional brutal attack on the continent and on Rome, then yeah, it's very it's actually kind of boring. Why is it there? Is to me one of the most interesting questions, which I obviously don't have a definitive answer to. I suspect it's there for a couple of reasons. There are some definite historical antecedents to this, and they show up earlier in Geoffrey of Monmouth's history as well. There's quite a number of both unsuccessful and successful attempts to conquer the Roman Empire that originated in Britain. Most famously, Constantine the Great, who actually did take the British legions and go down and conquer the Western Roman Empire and became ultimately the emperor of all of Rome. Others as well, like Maximian, who was less successful, did the same thing. The thing was to keep Britain safe, both from itself, the kind of squabbling nature of the Britons, which is so often condemned in the British's own writings about themselves and about Arthur. And also to keep out the Picts and the Scots and the various other people who were raiding and invading the Isle of Britain, you needed at least 3 legions. But 3 legions of Roman soldiers was a not insignificant power base from which to one could go down and take, particularly as Rome was weakening, take over part or all of the Empire of Rome. And as I say, Geoffrey actually chronicles some of this in his history of the British kings. Why? Well, I think if you want to celebrate the strength of your nation, your people, it doesn't hurt to say, hey, look, some like rulers of the whole Roman Empire came from Britain. And if you want to celebrate and glorify this figure, this historical figure who was a significant king of Britain, then why not have him go down and conquer that as well? Additionally, Geoffrey is writing, as I say, after the conquest of Britain by the Normans. So you now have this French connection to the Isle of Britain. And one of the things that Arthur does when he goes down and starts conquering, he starts conquering in Gaul, France, of course, and actually settles there. The other thing that I think that is kind of perhaps connected here is this stripping of Britain and its might and its strength as by these figures as they go down. That too probably resonates pretty deeply, particularly in the context of the Arthurian legend, as Arthur is seen as the last of the great kings of Britain, and there's a this significant stripping away of the strength of Britain did actually historically lead to the rise in the power of the Saxons as well as other invaders which led to the collapse of Roman Britain, British civilization. So there's this aspect that Lewis is condemning, and others, and taking Lewis as a representative. The other aspect that Lewis condemns as really boring and kind of weird is this these prophecies of Merlin. And just to take a random selection from the prophecies of Merlin, which go on and on and on. You have stuff like the brightness of the sun shall fade at the amber of Mercury, and horror shall seize the beholders. Stilbon of Arcadia shall change his shield. The helmet of Mars shall call Venus. The helmet of Mars shall make a shadow, and the rage of Mercury shall pass his bounds. Iron Orion shall unsheath his sword. The marine Phoebus shall torment the clouds. Jupiter shall go out of his lawful paths, and Venus forsake her stated lines. And so on and so forth. He keeps going on with these astrological signs. But I mean, he also talks as references to portions of Britain. A charioteer of York shall appease them, and having banished his lord, shall mount upon a chariot which he shall drive. With his sword unsheathed shall he threaten the east and fill the tracks of his wheels with blood. And so on. An owl shall build her nest upon the walls of Gloucester, and in her nest shall be brought forth an ass. The serpent of Malvernia shall bring him up and put him upon many fraudulent practices. Having taken the crown, he shall ascend on high and frighten the people of the country with his hideous braying. In his days shall the Pacatian mountains tremble, and the provinces be deprived of their woods. And so on. It just goes on and on and on. And it's, I actually rather love the, the conclusion of this, when he finally transitions out of the prophecies of Merlin, the conclusion is, Merlin, by delivering these and many other prophecies, caused in all that were present an admiration at the ambiguity of his expressions. Okay, yeah, they're pretty ambiguous. I'm not sure why they admired them, but they're pretty ambiguous. So I really do concur with Lewis's take that the historians have not always remembered to tell us that he's an author of mediocre talent and no taste. But all that being said, Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain and his sections in particular on the death of, on Arthur, and in particular on the death of Arthur and the circumstances surrounding that death, are pretty significant when it comes to determining the subsequent shape of the what becomes known as the Matter of Britain. It's in Geoffrey of Monmouth that we have Mordred's betrayal. So Mordred, or Mordrot in the Annals of Wales, is no longer somebody who Arthur is fighting beside. He is a nephew. He's related to Arthur. He's left in charge during Arthur's Roman campaign. But as Arthur is just about to complete his campaign, he's just defeated the Roman emperor, Licinius, I think, and he's about to go down and take over Rome when he hears that his nephew, Mordred, has betrayed him and has actually married Guinevere, his wife. The name is put a little differently, Guanhumara, right? Actually marries his nephew, Mordred, as Mordred calls in a collection of Arthur's enemies, mostly Saxons, but also Scots, Picts, Irish, and others. So here now, Mordred becomes this figure in Geoffrey of Monmouth, who first of all betrays his uncle Arthur, and is the one who Arthur's queen is unfaithful with, and he's also the one who unites Arthur's enemies against him. And now Arthur dies with him, but dies with him because he's fighting him. So these are really important subsequent elements of the Arthurian legend. Arthur is also related in Geoffrey of Monmouth as mortally wounded and carried to the Isle of Avalon to be cured. This is also is very important and is actually something that is condemned by somebody who lived around at the same time as Geoffrey, William of Newburgh, who condemns Geoffrey for weaving ridiculous figments of imagination around historical events recorded by the Venerable Bede. So the Venerable Bede, of course, did not mention Arthur, but William of Newburgh, as he's talking about Geoffrey's History of the Kings of Britain, he's also not particularly impressed because, hey, we've got these texts and these fairly from a fairly reliable source, much closer to the time period, the Venerable Bede, and Geoffrey is playing fast and loose with them. And he's also condemns him for cloaking these old British, quote, fables about Arthur with the honorable name of history by presenting them with the ornaments of the Latin tongue. As of course, Geoffrey of Monmouth is writing in Latin, which gives an air of scholarship and authority to the content that he's writing about. It's interesting that one of the possible motives that William of Newburgh ascribes to Geoffrey for doing this is to, quote, please the Britons, most of whom are known to be so primitive that they are said to still be waiting for the return of Arthur and will not suffer themselves to hear that he is dead, end quote. So it's first of all interesting that this attitude towards the native British people that William of Newburgh has, who's one of the Norman overlords, is that they're so primitive. They're still said to be awaiting the return of Arthur and will not suffer themselves to hear that he's dead. This is interesting both in terms of the sort of condescension that's there, but also in terms of what was resonating with the British people about the figure of Arthur, as he's now remembered at this period of history, is that he is this messianic figure. He's going to come back. He's not actually dead. And of course, Geoffrey of Monmouth does play to this, as William of Newburgh notes. William wonders how the old historians, to whom it was a matter of great concern that nothing worthy of memory should be omitted from what is written, could have suppressed with silence Arthur and his act, this king of the Britons, who is nobler than Alexander the Great, and further disparages Geoffrey for translating the fallacious prophecies of a certain Merlin, to which he has, in any event, added many things himself into Latin. So William of Newburgh is also not particularly impressed with Geoffrey's prophecies of Merlin. Another person writing about this time, Gerald of Wales, who also writes an account of the discovery of King Arthur's body, condemns Geoffrey's history with a fascinating story of a man who could see demons. And he says, "When he was harassed beyond endurance by these unclean spirits," this man who could see demons, "St. John's Gospel was placed in his lap. And then they all vanished immediately, flying away like so many birds. If the gospel were afterwards removed, and the history of the kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth put there in its place, just to see what would happen, the demons would alight all over his body, and on the book too, staying there longer than usual and being even more demanding." So the Geoffrey's history of the kings of Britain was not necessarily particularly well received by all his contemporaries, but he was writing in Latin. He was writing just around the time of the just after the time of the Norman conquest, and his account seems to have been picked up and to have resonated with not only with the British but also with the French, and that then it is leads to various writings about Arthur later on in French. There's the French prose cycle, which includes Lancelot, Quest for the Grail, Mort d'Arthur, which Sir Thomas Malory later refers back to as his French book, and as also other works in English that then are derived to some extent from this and also from other sources. There's a 14th century English alliterative poem, Old English alliterative poem called Mort Arthur, and a stanzaic poem called Le Mort Arthur, which again, there's this focus on the death of Arthur as this moment in British history that is a, well, hugely significant one for the British people. All that being said, so Geoffrey doesn't get, well, he doesn't get a lot of respect, and I think to some extent deservedly so, from some of his contemporaries and from literary figures like C.S. Lewis looking back on him. He nevertheless is hugely influential as in terms of his portrayal of King Arthur, and most significantly, I think, of his death and the circumstances surrounding his death. So, as I've said, Mordred's betrayal figures in here. Guinevere's infidelity figures here. Arthur is mortally wounded. He's carried to the Isle of Avalon to be cured. It doesn't say whether or not he survives, but the implication is left there, the possibility is left there that he is alive and possibly returning. Arthur's kinsman Constantine succeeds the throne, but a rapid succession of rivals who replace one another with civil war accompanying this over the next 10 years or so leads to the wasting of what is left of them and the domination of the Saxons. So you have still the Saxons coming in the background. It's less significant now in Geoffrey's rendition of the death of Arthur and its aftermath, but it's still there. We also have the beginnings of the subsequent shape of the matter of Britain. There's all sorts of elements here that we can see picked up by later writers and really developed, and as we'll see later, developed to kind of almost the pinnacle of the English Arthurian tradition in Sir Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur. There's a theme of freedom, for example, and honor. Uther, King Uther, Uther Pendragon, Arthur's father, on defeating the Saxons, when he's leading his troops on a litter, he's being carried on a litter because he's ill, says, "Victory to me, half dead, is better than to be safe and sound and vanquished. For to die with honor is preferable to living with disgrace." So this sense of honor and of the value of a noble death, which is so key to what becomes the, I think, the underlying tenor and power of the Arthurian legend is right here. There's, as I say, Mordred's betrayal, Guinevere's infidelity, although it's with Mordred, and Mordred's betrayal is no not Arthur's son as he is in Mallory. Here he's Arthur's nephew, but he's still Arthur's kinsman. But there's other elements as well, like there's a single combat between Arthur and Flodo, which I believe it takes place in Gaul, in that part of Geoffrey of Monmouth when Arthur is down conquering Gaul. There's a single combat between these two, Arthur and Flodo, and it looks a lot like a joust. There's also a tournament. There's a 3-day tournament at Arthur's coronation with prizes given on the fourth, which includes an activity where the military men composed a kind of diversion in imitation of a fight on horseback, and the ladies placed in a sportive manner darted their amorous glances at the courtiers, the more to encourage them. We start to see a number of things here, and I don't think it's coincidental. This is being written, I think, round about the same time as the Song of Roland. This is being written at the time when this notion of a knightly class, this warrior class, which is governed by rules, rules of honor, rules of chivalry, the beginnings of a notion of chivalry, are here, and starting to filter into the Arthurian legend, become associated with Arthur as a king. These will then be picked up and become really key in the Arthurian legend, like inextricable, really, inextricably intertwined with them. And of course, there's the element of civil war, which Geoffrey condemns in a manner not unlike his predecessor Gildas, where he's lamenting, "Oh, foolish nation, oppressed with the weight of your abominable wickedness. Why did you, in your insatiable thirst after civil war, so weaken yourself by domestic confusions that whereas formerly you brought distant kingdoms under your yoke?" Remember Rome, right? "Now, like a good vineyard degenerated and turned to bitterness, you cannot defend your country, your wives and children against your enemies." So we have the fall of Britain isn't attributed primarily to outside forces. It's attributed now primarily, and we see hints of this before, but now it's much more kind of full blown. It's attributed primarily to the disunity of the British people and their fighting amongst themselves. So what is to be concluded from this? Well, besides noting the these themes that are grafted into the matter of Britain, the Arthurian legend, themes of chivalry, themes of freedom and honor, and themes of civil strife and the weakness that ensues from that. I think it's not insignificant that Geoffrey of Monmouth, writing in the context of the conquest of Britain by William the Conqueror, wants to portray Arthur as not merely the King of Britain, but also King of France, potential ruler of the Roman Empire, and a figure that is a unifying force that can then strengthen the whole of the people and bring peace and safety and security if only they stop fighting with one another. If only these various enemies of stability and strength and power, the often represented by the Scots and the Picts and the British people themselves, and of course the Saxons, who have just been conquered by William of Nor of William the Conqueror, William of Normandy, that these are the problems that need to be addressed, need to be put shoved aside, in favor of the strong, great ruler Arthur. And Arthur is, and I, it does play t well to the British people to say, hey, and he's coming back. He's going to make things better again, or at least open, keep that possibility open. I think it's also significant that Geoffrey, while he's writing a history of the kings of Britain, isn't actually that concerned with history. He's actually more interested in the story, which allows him to bring in all these other elements without regard to what the historical Arthur was actually like, or even if he actually existed. His disregard for the historical Arthur allows him to bring in all these diverse threads from his own time, and then this gets reworked by the people who read his writings in a similar fashion, with that similar kind of freedom. So that this transition then under Geoffrey of Monmouth, with Arthur as one of the kings of Britain that he's writing a quote-unquote history about, really does transition Arthur from an historical figure into a literary figure, and thus gives the various authors more freedom to elaborate on Arthur in ways that relate to their own culture, their own time, the problems that they themselves are facing, and to look to Arthur in terms of both of that apocalyptic collapse of society, which we so often see around us as human beings. This is either imminent or happening or did happen. And also to see Arthur within that context as a kind of idealistic, messianic figure, someone to whom we should look and who is both inspirational and potentially salvific.